I'd worked as a tour leader in lots of different countries. I was meant to be in China for 9 months and then leave, but from the first day I was here, I just loved China and everyone I met, so I never did leave. At some point I said, I'll wait until the first day I'm unhappy and then I'll leave, but that day hasn't happened yet.
I had traveled to almost 110 countries, wow. And I felt that very few of them had any understanding of China. And I wanted to add a voice and share the experiences of real China that we both feel every day.
Yes. The best, biggest change for me was when I moved there in 2009. Everyone in the village was either a grandparent or a grandchild. And that changed within the first 2 years of me being in the village. Tourism really picked up bamboo rafting on the Yulong River. The sort of citrus fruit industry really started to take off. A lot of women did fruit picking, and then people had money, started building houses. So men and women all did construction work. So that was the best thing because all the families got back together. And I think that really changed the whole feeling of the village. People's lives have improved a lot.
And I feel that what this has done is, in the villages here, what I have seen is the investment in infrastructure that the government has made has instilled so much pride and hope among the people. Man, the greatest thing it has given is giving people hope.
The Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
Hello and welcome to The Chat Lounge. I'm Tuyin. In this episode of our special series, My Expat Life in Rural China, I'm sitting down with American Brian Linden and South African Ian Hamilton for a chat about their lives in rural China. Welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're happy to be here.
Yes.
Thanks. In fact, I'm a guest today here. Right now, we are sitting in the library of a branch of Siling Yuan.
Yes, yes.
Also known as the Linden Center, which is a chain of a boutique hotels run by Brian. Thanks for hosting us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you for coming. Yeah, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Right. And welcome back to the show, Brian. Actually, it's the second time for you to be on the show. And a warm welcome to Ian as well.
Thank you.
It's your first time the show. So would you please introduce yourself a little bit to our audience?
Yes, sure. My name is Ian Hamilton, and I come from South Africa. I studied architecture in South Africa. But when I came to China, I was actually working for a travel company as a tour leader. That was in 2001. I'd worked as a tour leader in lots of different countries. I was meant to be in China for 9 months and then leave. But I, from the first day I was here, I just loved China and everyone I met. So I never did leave. At some point I said, I'll wait until the first day I'm unhappy and then I'll leave. But that day hasn't happened yet. So thank you to everybody in China. I live in Guangxi, Guilin, Yangshuo. I have a boutique hotel there.
That's a beautiful place.
Yes, very beautiful scenery and very beautiful people.
Mm. And Brian, you've been quite famous in China and also to our overseas audience, but would you please give a brief introduction as well?
Sure. My name is Brian Linden and I come from Chicago. My first time in China, I came in 1984 and spent more or less 4 years. And China had such an impact on my life at that time that in 2004, my wife and I decided to give up our jobs in the States and sold all our property, our house, and brought our children here. And the goal was really to add a new voice, a narrative to the story of China. I had traveled to almost 110 countries, wow. And I felt that very few of them had any understanding of China. And I felt that somehow I felt that was part of my role. I love China. Mm. And I wanted to add a voice and share the experiences of real China that we both feel every day.
Yes.
And kind of show the world that there is this incredible part of China that they have no idea about.
You're so blessed. 109 countries?
109, not including, well, I haven't ever counted them. But, I assume it's about 110 now.
Oh, right.
But somewhere around there.
Wow, I'm envious. And you both lived and worked in cities, right? But eventually you decided to stay in villages in China. Why? Maybe Ian first?
Yeah, I was after, in 2001 and 2002, I was traveling all around China working as a tour leader. And then in 2003, I started living in Guilin in Yangshou in the town. I was working in the office for the travel company then, and that was in Yangshou town. But after a few years, I think it was by 2008, 2009, Yangshou had become so popular with tourists that it was full of bars and nightclubs, and it was just noisy all day. It was too renal for me. It was hard to sleep at night. So I thought, yeah, I wanted to get out to somewhere more peaceful. So then I moved out. And originally in South Africa, I come from the countryside as well. So I'm not really used to big towns or cities.
You're like a village lover.
Yes, I'm very happy. I think village life is fantastic, especially in China. There's such a sense of community in China in villages, which we don't really have so much in the West. But everybody knows everybody. In the village I live in, everybody's related to everybody. But they all call me uncle and big brother and grandfather or whatever. And it's this beautiful feeling where everybody, you feel like one big family. So that's what I love the most about countryside life.
And Brian, from a city boy to a villager, what prompted the change or the choice?
You know, it was a strategic choice on our part. I have learned to love the villages. I really do. But the idea was, in some way, if I wanted to share a different narrative and add another voice about China to the outside world, I felt the voice about Sanlitun, the voices of Shenzhen, the voices of the Gaotier, of Dakucha, were being shared to the outside world. Right. And the world was respecting China for what I feel is its hard power.
We have to explain Sanlitun is a bustling place in Beijing, right?
Yeah, and what I felt that in somehow, having been here from 84 to 88, I felt that many of these bustling places represented the recent 30 years of changes in China. And I felt that we were so proud of those 30 years of changes that sometimes we forgot to tell the story of the 4,970 years that preceded this. And so what I felt is that just adding a voice to the Sanlitun crowd was not necessary. Mm. What I felt that in somehow I had to challenge, initially, maybe outsiders, to experience China in a different way, to get away from their comfort zones. And that's why we chose to do our first site in where we are now in Xizhou.
Nice. Ian, you got a nickname, Crazy Ian.
Yeah.
So what's the story behind that?
What people say is, because when I moved into the village I live in now, Joseon Village in Yangshou, for years and years, I'd had this dream about renting one old house, because when I first arrived in Yangshou, all the villages were full of these beautiful ancient buildings, and a lot of them had been taken down by people to build new houses or just been abandoned and fallen down. And I just thought they're so beautiful. We don't have old buildings in South Africa, and I thought someone should try and save one. And everyone in the villages said to me, yeah, these buildings have no use. So I was just planning on renting one house and renovating it and showing people that the old buildings still have use. Mm-hmm. Because I can't buy buildings in the countryside. I just rented the house for 20 years. And because the first building was owned by six families, they wanted me to pay all 20 years rent up front. And then I spent my own money and hired my landlords and neighbors to work on the building and set up a business. And then in 20 years, I'm going to return that to the landlord. So everyone in the village just said, you're crazy. Why would you do this? Why would you take an old ruin that nobody wants, give money to the landlords, then hire them to work on it, and then give it back to them? So then they just started calling me Fongzi, crazy. Right. Yeah.
Fortunately, you see the beauty in the buildings.
Yeah.
Right. Brian, what about you?
A similar story to Ian. We came here and we felt the same way, and we felt that somehow these old buildings, heritage, could still play such an important role in the revitalization and the vitality of the communities, in the pride that the villagers have. We felt that in many cases, China and its push for economic kind of improvements would often move, the things were happening so quickly. And sometimes the idea of preservation was not taken as seriously as maybe I feel we should now. And I think we're reevaluating that, here in China. So I feel it's very similar to Ian. These buildings, in many ways, still have so much purpose and still serve as such a touchstone for the foundation for the local people. And it's a sense of pride. And we only worked with the locals as well in restoring these buildings. It was their grandparents, great-grandparents who built them. Why should we be bringing people from outside to work on these buildings? Mm-hmm. So I feel very similar, you know, Ian.
Yeah. Right. So correct me if I'm wrong. I learned that both you invested all the money you had in the hotels at the very beginning. So did you think about the consequences if the investment failed? You could be penniless, right? Mm-hmm. Was it never an issue to you?
I want to hear about Fung's.
Okay.
I'll tell you, I'm not a businessman, and I don't make business plans. When I rented the house that I rented, my plan was that I was just going to live in it myself, because it was quite a big house, not as big as these beautiful buildings, but it had a courtyard and it was quite big. And in my mind, I did think, because I'm also an artist, I like to paint, and I did think I could have rooms and maybe artists could come and stay, or authors or photographers. But I didn't think of doing business. My plan was to live there myself. And when I was negotiating for the lease, in the end, the landlords wanted more money, but I had all the money I had in the world, and I basically just said, that's all I can pay. And when they all agreed, then that was it. That was all the money I had in the world. Yeah. The funny thing was, they said they wanted to go to the bank and transfer the money. And I went to the bank, gave one of the landlords the money. He got on a motorbike and disappeared. And I was stood on the side of the road going, hang on, we haven't even signed yet. But he just went to fetch his brother, so they weren't going to sign. But I did panic that I was actually, because they couldn't even prove they owned the house. Mm. So I was, when I gave all my money away, I was almost having a heart attack. I was really panicking that I wasn't even going to get the building.
Right.
But I didn't, I never thought it through. I didn't actually ever plan on doing any business. So I wasn't really worried about that. I was just thinking, oh, I'm going to live in the house. But then because I didn't have any money left, I didn't have money to renovate the building. So I actually got a friend of mine to come and be a partner, and then we did a guest house. So that wasn't really my plan. And when the guest house opened, I think it was October in 2011, we didn't have a single customer, and we were in this tiny village that didn't even have a proper road into it, and it was just raining every day, and I was sat on my own in my beautiful empty building thinking, well, whose idea was it to do business in this village?
Were you thinking of like giving it up, or?
Well, that first winter was very hard because I think the rain was like my tears falling from the sky. I was just on my own in this building in the cold and the rain going, "This, no one's coming. This is a really bad idea." But because I'd worked for a travel company and my business partner had also worked for a travel company, at the end of the year, often the travel companies travel around China visiting different places, and we contacted them and they came and looked and said, this is what we want, is a chance for foreigners to stay in the countryside, not all in big cities. So the second year, we actually started getting some customers.
Thank goodness. That's good, yeah.
But I wouldn't have been worried if it hadn't worked. My goal was to preserve the building. So it wasn't to run a business or something. So it didn't matter to me whether it was successful or not. We did have to borrow quite a lot of money, but I would have found a job and paid it back.
Yeah, it's all about hobby.
Yeah, yeah.
And Brian, I think you got a different story to tell.
Well, similar to Ian, I mean, I felt the same passion to do this.
Obvious.
But I owe so much to China for giving me a scholarship in 1983 to come over here to study. It changed my life. I would be cleaning carpet still in America had it not been for China. So because of this, I did not feel really too much of a risk. I felt I really owed it to this country, because everything from going from a carpet cleaner to a night school kid to a community college kid to a Stanford PhD program, you know, one of the first people to get that, it was all because of China. So I was Brian. I was the guy I was because China took a chance on me. And I felt that I had nothing to lose. I owed it to this country, because without this country, I would never be in the position to even share what I wanted to, you know, what we're trying to do. So no, I didn't feel too much of a risk. But that had to be a family decision. My wife had to be involved, and she had to agree as well, which she did.
Running a business is quite different from, you know, studying in this country. What gave you that confidence?
Well, no, in a way, our business may be similar to Ian's. In a way, it's our social enterprise.
Right.
It's a way of making, you know, some money, of keeping us going, But there's so many other things I want to do. As you know, we do education, I have a museum, we do volunteer libraries, we're developing hiking trails in the rural, and that's kind of our goal. That's what inspires me.
Right.
And the hotel is really our way of, in some way, funding those things. Just like you with your arts and architecture, you wanted to protect that building.
Yeah.
And I wanted to protect that building as well. And we came
found
up
a
with
way.
A way, found a way to make it work,
you know? Yeah.
Yeah, both of you chose to preserve the building, to preserve the original style. But were you required to do this in the very beginning by local authorities, or was it your original plan?
I think we have different stories, but you could go first if you want.
No, when I first started, because I'm an architect in South Africa, when you want to do a renovation or a new building, the first thing you do is go to all the government departments and get approval. So you go to the fire department and the planning. So in Yangshuo, I then said to my business partner that she should go to all the different government departments and see what sort of approval and what requirements they are. And they all said, yeah, there's nothing. Just do it and then come back when you're finished to get all your licenses. So there was never any requirements from the government for us until we'd finished all the work. And then we had to go to all the different departments, and then they came along and kind of said, or the fire department said, oh, there's way too much wood. It's a fire risk. And sort of, but then they, worked with us and told us how to solve it all. But during the building process, they had no requirements. Because I thought the first house I rented was so beautiful, I wanted to preserve as much of that as possible. And I wanted the feeling of it being a house, not it being a hotel or something. So my thought from the very beginning was, the person who built this building 150 years ago or whenever, if they were here today and they were going to change it, how would they change it? I'm sure they would use new building materials, because there are new building materials available, but they would want to keep the spirit of the building.
Sure.
So that's what I tried to do, was change it, because it's obviously its use is changing, and we had to put bathrooms in and all these types of things, but to try and keep that original spirit of the building. So for me, the happiest thing ever was when we got Chinese customers come. I think the first Spring Festival, we had a Chinese family came and booked. When we opened, we only had 6 rooms, and they booked all 6 rooms, and they said they wanted to go home for the Spring Festival, but their village, the buildings had already been knocked down, and they'd come to Secret Garden when I was building, and they'd seen it, and they said it gave them the feeling of going back to their own home in their village. And so that was so happy that day, because that was really all I wanted, was to still keep that feeling of it, like going home.
And Brian, when it comes to your story, the Yangpingxiang's house and the Baocheng's house, two components of Xilingyuan, are national heritage sites, right?
Yes.
So there are strict requirements when it comes to their preservation and development. Have the rules made it much harder for you to renovate or turn it into hotels?
Yeah, I think that renovating a heritage site is often much more expensive and much more complicated than building new. And even after a renovation, even if we throw a lot of money at this project, we still can't replicate the comforts of a newly constructed hotel. So we feel that in some ways these old buildings deserved restoration. We needed to restore them, almost in a Lian Sicheng, Xiu Jiu Ru Jiu, the idea of just preserving them. We were not going to alter them to cater to outside tourist interests. Mm. All we were going to do is present them, preserve them and present them to the public. And if people were enchanted by their original charm, all the better. But what we had to do was inject a lot of content. So we have education programs. As you know, each Linden Center has about 50% of the space dedicated to public spaces. Mm. Where we are now here, we have a cooking school, we have a fitness kind of complex, we have a yoga center, a conference center, and we've dedicated so much of what would be a typical businessman's, efforts in maximizing all the space and turning them into guest rooms. Mm. We have turned them into public spaces so that the public still feels very, very welcome here. And that's hard to do. It was really hard to do. We had a lot of, they continue every week to come and visit and check to be sure that nothing is being altered. So, but the government has been so supportive. And I believe they're supportive because they support our values. They support the values of what we're trying to achieve. Mm. And that's something that we're always quite honored that we have had this opportunity to do this, these kind of projects.
Can you recall any difficult parts of these buildings, that were very hard to repair.
Oh, of course, of course. Just like you, I mean, we had so many and, you know.
Give us an example, like which part?
Well, in the Yangpingxiang, you know, when we first did this, I had a hard time articulating what we wanted to achieve. So we, you know, that is why I call the place Center, C-E-N-T-R-E. Mm-hmm. I called it that because the hotel was our social part. I mean, our business part. We wanted to do so much more than that. Mm-hmm. So it's not called the Linden Hotel or Shijo Hotel. Mm-hmm. We called it a center because we really wanted to have a social impact and preserve. When I first articulated this image or vision to the government, they didn't realize that we wanted to have bathrooms in the room. Oh. So they thought that, you know, the complex is, you know, 200 meters long, and they thought we could have a bathroom at the end of one complex so that people in the middle of the night would have to walk 200 meters to the bathroom. Mm. So all these things were very, very challenging. How do you incorporate the plumbing into an old structure? Mm. And we've I think, done a really good job of doing that without destroying in any way the original structure.
Right. And in terms of Secret Garden, Ian, were there any parts of the buildings that you felt were so impossible to repair that you almost gave up?
Probably before I started, I gave up on one building. The first house I rented was a big courtyard house, and it had a small building behind it, which had originally been like kitchens and for animals and things. Mm-hmm. And there'd actually been a fire in it. And the main house itself had been abandoned for about 10 years. So it had quite a lot of damage inside from leaks in the roof and things. But the back building, there'd been a fire and the roof was gone and half of it had fallen in at the top. Mm. And when I was renting the main house, the people who owned the building behind said, did I want to rent that? And it was very cheap. And I didn't really think I wanted it, but they said, oh, it was against the mountain. And they said, it comes with the mountain. Wow. And I thought, oh, I can have a mountain. So I was very excited. So I was like, yeah, I'll rent it. But my original plan was just to leave it. I thought it's a ruin. Because this was my first project of actually doing renovation work myself. And I didn't think I'd be able to do that. So when I started work, I started working on the main house. But because I'm also an artist and I'd always thought I'd love to have my own gallery, and I thought, oh, I could have a gallery in the building behind. So in the end, I actually started working on that building as well. Oh. Yeah, it was really, really hard work because it was very badly damaged. The outside walls of the houses I have are the gray brick, but the walls are about half a meter thick, and inside it's mud brick. Mm-hmm. And so that building, all the mud bricks had washed away. And the one wall was still two stories high, but it was only a single brick. And they never used cement, it was just mud. So you could actually push the wall with your hands and the whole wall would wobble. It was beautiful. But yeah, we managed to rebuild the inside without the wall falling down. But at the start, there were trees growing in the building and stuff. But they were, even when I was working, there were times, especially when we were doing the roof and it was raining every day, and I was just thinking, oh, why am I doing this?
You're listening to The Chat Lounge. We'll be back right after this.
Why China instead of other countries? Why the village instead of the city? As China's rural revitalization continues, we talk to expats to find out their reasons for choosing to live in the country's villages for years or even decades. Know more about what's going on in China's vast rural areas through My Expat Life in Rural China, here on Chat Lounge.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Chat Lounge. We continue our chat with Brian Linden, founder of Xiling Yuan, or the Linden Center, and Ian Hamilton, founder of The Secret Garden, about their lives in rural China. Let's move on to the operation of the hotels. What was the biggest challenge in running the hotels, Brian?
Trying to get customers.
Yeah, that's always a challenge.
No, I think that, I don't know, Ian, if you agree, but just like we wanted our hotels to be almost like a family. Mm. We've lived for 18 years in our hotel. We raised our boys here. We homeschooled our boys in the hotels. So we wanted our hotels to feel like a big family. And we hired local staff, only local staff. At one time, Xiling Yuan, our first site, has 16 guest rooms. Mm-hmm. We had about 50 staff. And I was developing everything, trying to develop travel programs, trying to employ as many locals as I could.
So that's supposed to be a lot.
Oh, yeah. Right. One to one is even...
Yeah, we had about 13 or 14 for like 18 rooms, staff members, 13, 14 staff members, and everyone laughs at me. It says, you've got
too many. Huh?
Yeah, twice as much as you need.
But see, what we tried to do as well was we had them doing travel programs. We provided free tours. We provided. So I was trying to think of ways, how could I employ the locals? How could I give them, make sure that they were getting the greatest benefit from our being in their backyard? Mm-hmm. And this was something that was really challenging for us financially in the beginning. Mm. In the beginning, I subsidized the business. Mm. We didn't pull a salary. We didn't take a salary ourselves. We felt we had to do this in order to create a model that we felt was more, I guess, you know, giving to the community. And this is something we've tried to continue to this day. Mm. The problem is, though, with the increased competition, it makes it increasingly difficult to do.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so much competition now, and a lot of competition, maybe the investment is solely in the infrastructure. You know, you can get by now by just designing a really sexy design.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have people really, you don't have to have a lot of staff. Mm. The sexy design satisfies 95% of what their customers need.
Makes sense.
Where we really wanted it to be, you know, maybe our building was satisfying 70%, 60%. Of the customer's needs, but our passion, our storytelling, our content would, you know, improve it to 100%.
Yeah.
Ian, you mentioned finding more customers is the challenge. I bet that you've encountered a lot of difficulties, especially during the COVID pandemic period.
Yeah.
How did you manage to, you know, to overcome the difficulty?
I think we were very lucky because when I rented, in the end, the Secret Garden expanded to be 6 buildings. Just 1 year, I kept renovating one building every year. But all of them I rented for 20 years, and all of them I paid all the rent up front. So during the pandemic, we didn't have any rent to pay because we'd paid all that already. And then our staff being local, quite a lot of them had recently had babies because of the change in policy. So quite a few of the staff were happy to only work 1 week a month or take a few months off or something. So we basically just kind of downscaled everything to the point where we didn't have to spend a lot of money.
Right.
And then whenever there was a holiday when it was safe for people to travel, because the staff were locals and they could all come back when we were busy. Mm. So it worked out very well, we were very lucky. And always people in the village were really helpful and supportive of us as well through the pandemic. So we didn't really make any money, but I don't think we ended up losing money.
So did thoughts of giving up ever cross your mind during the period?
No, again, because for me, it was never about doing business. It was about saving the buildings. Yes. And at the very beginning, my little world that I live in my head, in my dreamland, I thought if I can save one building, other people can see it and they can come and save buildings around. And that actually happened, amazingly. So all the buildings around us, after we opened, no more of the old houses got knocked down and they all got saved. And I was just so happy. I never thought that would really happen. And so I think, I was just so lucky that I was able to help be part of this process. And for me, that's what it was all about. So it didn't really, it just doesn't really matter. I eat mifan and drink mijo. I can live on 21 a day or something. So I was fine. It didn't really matter. I have my lovely life in the village and it didn't really matter about being successful.
All, yeah. It's good that you eventually survived this. We all eventually survived this horrible period.
The whole world,
And Brian, you mentioned you hired, actually both of you hired a lot of locals, but have you encountered any problems in communication, especially in the initial phase, because they were farmers, and if they have to adapt themselves into this new role of serving others, were there any difficulties?
You know, I don't know about you, Ian, but I've had very few. I've had very few difficulties with them, and I find that because they are so proud of our efforts in their villages. The support we get is really incredible. And so it's really hard for me to point to any really negative experiences. I made some mistakes, which as an economist, I shouldn't have made. When I first started, I heard that the local salary was about 40 renminbi a day, you know, for the workers who worked on our staff. Yeah. So I said, I'm going to, you know, help these. I'm going to come here and do something good.
Yeah.
I'm going to offer 50 renminbi a day.
Which is around, like, How many U.S. dollars?
Oh, it was about $7 a day. Okay. But I felt that I wanted to do that to show my respect to the locals. We had 100 people a day working on the restoration. Mm. And it immediately caused some problems in the village, because suddenly, as you know, people will tend to move to where they're getting the best salaries.
Sure.
And I skewed the salary kind of rate to here in the village, and people were not so happy on some of the other businesses. That was a mistake on my part, and I acknowledge that. But it was out of good feelings, you know? The intention was good.
Of course.
But the implementation was probably not the smartest thing to do. So, But no, I have not had Ian. I don't know if you have, but I have had very, very good luck.
When I first started, I'd only just moved to the village. People didn't really know me. And then when I rented the first house and the second one, I made mistakes. I moved someone's rock. It was a rock, and I didn't think anything of it.
It was not supposed to be moved.
It was not meant to be moved. And the guy was very upset with me. Well, probably not very upset, but in my mind he was, because people in the village talk very loudly, stand very close, kind of shout. And I thought everyone was like angry with me, but I think in the end it's not. It's just the way people are. But I had a few things like that where people didn't know me and they thought I was doing something on purpose. And like this rock, in the end, the guy said his grandfather went up the mountain and brought that rock down and put it there because it was to mark the boundary or something. And it was a bit in the way, so I moved it. And I was like, okay, stop shouting, I'll just move it back. I had a few things like that. One of the landlords, someone told him I was going to knock his building down because one of the walls was unsafe and we were taking the mud bricks down. And he came and said, "You're tearing my building down." I said, "No, we're not. It's unsafe. We're going to rebuild it." But because someone in the village had said I was going to knock it down, he believed them and not me. Mm-hmm. But I was helped a lot by the village leader and Communist Party secretary in the village. They helped me negotiate for the first house to rent as well. So when I had trouble, I would phone them and they would come along and say, "It's this Fungs is not doing anything on purpose.
Yes.
It's okay, like calm down." And then of course they would believe like the village leader. But after, once people got to know me and then they realized if there was any problem, they could just come and tell me and say, "Don't chop that tree down," or "Yes, you can chop that tree down." And then afterwards, once we all knew each other, there was no trouble.
And Brian, you mentioned you've held a lot of activities to make your hotels more attractive to people in the country or from outside the country around the world. So among all the activities you offer, which one has been the most popular?
Every day we offer two free tours here to everyone who stays at the center. And one is a tour of the Shijo village, and then one is an architecture tour, the traditional architecture of the region.
That's nice.
One of the things that I'm proud of pre-COVID is that we used to offer to all our guests an opportunity to share their passions. So for example, if you were to come to Shijo, we would say, "Ian, you're an architect. Could you share your experiences of being an architect around the world, doing what you're doing with the villagers, not just with our guests?" Mm. But that is why we build places that allow us to sit 50, 70 people. So then in the evenings, we open that up to the public. And what that means is for the guests themselves, it gives them an opportunity to have an interaction with the local people that is much more genuine. It's not like we're just sitting there taking photos of them. Yeah. We're sharing our own passions with them, and they're asking questions back to us. And this is something that I was very, very proud of, and we will continue doing this in the future. The other thing is that our mission was always diplomacy. How do we tell the story? And I have been able to interact and partner with some very, very important schools around the world to bring their students to the small village of Shijo. And not just for a week, but sometimes for 4 months, a whole semester. Mm. And that includes President Obama's girls' school. Mm. We have America's leaders' children coming to a small village in rural Yunnan. Mm. And they are coming here and they are studying the village.
That's incredible.
Yunnan. And that becomes their curriculum. And they get credit for it. And they go on and they will be America's future leaders.
Yeah.
They will always hold some kind of emotional tie to China. And we are always looking at ways to really do that. We feel that's the foundation of soft power.
Mm.
And so we are always trying to create these ways of just sharing China's soft power in a more genuine way.
Right. Obviously, you got a big plan there. What about Ian? The activities that you have at your hotels that most popular among visitors?
What we used to do, which was most popular, but we don't do anymore, was actually just take people for a meal in someone's house in the village.
Right.
But that was when there were still people still living in old mud brick houses or the grey brick houses, once they knocked those buildings down or people moved into new concrete buildings, then it wasn't quite so popular anymore because people wanted to kind of sit in, like, you know, they all have that old feeling of being in a house and stuff. But we teach people like making local food, or I have another guest house actually in Liuzhou, Sanjiang, Cheng'an Bazai, The Lost World, and that's in a Dong minority village. And we do actually a lot more activities there, teaching people to dyeing the cloth, making zongzi, the sticky rice, parcels. And
tie dyeing.
So the Dong minority do a beautiful dark blue indigo cloth. And they also have a place where you can learn sort of woodworking skills and things, because they do beautiful wood buildings. So they actually teach children, they make pieces. It's kind of like an IKEA house. You can put all the little wood pieces together and stuff.
Cool.
So people, especially children, really enjoy that. Or activities in the village where you sort of, if people are interested, you say, okay, well, it's rice planting season, you can go and help our neighbors planting rice or harvesting rice or stuff.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, people really enjoy the local experience.
And then you've been living in Guangxi, Yangshuo, for 15 years already?
20 years. But the village I'm in, I've been there for 13 years in Joseon Village.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So then what would you say was the biggest change that took place in the village you've been living in?
Yeah, I could talk about the village I'm in because I'm most familiar with that, but everything changed. The best, biggest change for me was when I moved there in 2009. Everyone in the village was either a grandparent or a grandchild. Everyone who was in their 20s, 30s, 40s was usually in Guangdong or somewhere else working away from home. And they'd just come back for Spring Festival and the family would all be reunited and they'd see their children like once a year. And that changed within the first 2 years of me being in the village. Tourism really picked up, bamboo rafting on the Yulong River. So a lot of men came back to do bamboo rafting. The sort of citrus fruit industry really started to take off. A lot of women did fruit picking, and then people had money, started building houses. So men and women all did construction work. So that was the best thing because all the families got back together. And I think that really changed the whole feeling of the village. For me, that's probably why I ended up staying. I think I might not have otherwise, that it just became a whole community again, which I think was missing. But then the government, already during the financial crisis, started spending money on infrastructure and put in roads, sewerage, running water, refuse collection, the canals for rainwater and stuff. None of that was there before. So the village became much cleaner. Yeah, no, there was never running water or sewerage or anything. So, I mean, all of those improvements are incredible. Mm. And job opportunities for people. So it's, I mean, everything changed. It was really hard to get into the village before because it was just a little dirt track and you could only drive small tractors and things through because the road was narrow and windy. And now this nice concrete road. Mm. And so I think people's lives have improved a lot. People have more time for drinking and eating.
That's nice. Right, and what's your story, Brian?
You know, I echo everything that Ian says. Mm-hmm. And I feel that what this has done is, in the villages here, what I have seen is the investment in infrastructure that the government has made has instilled so much pride and hope among the people. Right. So you have people now not feeling that the only pathway to success is through Dongguan or through Guangdong.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They can come back here now and be a part. They can be close to their families. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, you know, it needed that investment. And who would do that investment? Mm-hmm. In other countries, a private entrepreneur would not do it.
Yeah.
Somebody had to take on this burden and the government did it. Mm-hmm. I can go from Bali to Kunming in 2 hours. So I can go there and have a hospital visit, go see the dentist, and I can come back. When I first came here in 1985, it took me 12 hours overnight from Kunming to Bali. Mm-hmm. So this inspires people. And this is when we talk about Shansun Jianxin, you know, rural revitalization, the greatest thing it has given is giving people hope because they see around them people investing in them, investing in their communities. Yeah. And this really inspires not just them, it inspires me, you know, and this is, so these are the kind of stories that I feel in some way, I want to tell the world, you know, we are lucky enough to experience these things and the world doesn't know about them sometimes.
I know you can't wait, but for the moment, let's just focus on yourself. What do you appreciate the most and regret the most so far about living in rural China?
Regrets, very few regrets, I have to say. I don't have any regrets.
I can't, I can't think of any.
Yeah, sometimes I like sports, so maybe I haven't been able to watch some football games. I mean, that's right. About the only thing. So.
I thought I would really miss like art exhibitions.
Yeah,
or
exactly.
But I haven't at all.
I agree completely. Mm. So no regrets and joys, I think, are endless. Yeah. To be honest, our lives, the things that you experience, we experience. Yeah. You know, just interacting with the local people, sharing, having dinner with them. Mm. These are things that sometimes we don't experience outside of China.
Right.
And I think that's the essence of China. This kind of feeling, isn't it incredible?
Isn't it
wonderful to have a friend come from afar?
Right.
This 2,500-year-old tradition, because Confucius, it's kind of passed down. Mm. It's still alive here in the Chinese people. And I think all our viewers should realize that as foreigners here, we still are so warmly received and we still get so much respect.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same. I can't think of anything I would say, any regrets. I mean, I come from the countryside and I love living in a village. I think it's an amazing life. For me, the best part is, in the village I live in, a lot of people are surnamed Mao, and they call me Mao Fengzi, and my name was up in the ancestors' hall with all the
cool,
Mao family.
Wow.
And last week we all went to Fuchuan, Hezhou, Fuchuan. All the Mao people get together once a year, and we had like 6,000 people all get together and we have lunch together. And I go with because they say I'm Mao Fengzi.
That's such an honor.
Oh, it's the greatest honor I could ever imagine. People, they treat me like I'm really genuinely family. And I feel embarrassed because I think if these people who are calling me brother and uncle and stuff, if they went to South Africa, people wouldn't treat them like that. Especially not in a small village, wouldn't welcome outsiders from anywhere that much. So I think for me, and it was really at the start of the pandemic, it was really, really shown very clearly to me because the village roads were sealed off. And for 6 weeks, I didn't leave the village. And all the businesses were shut. And all my neighbors raise their own chickens and grow their own green vegetables and plant their own rice, but I have nothing. And everyone knew that I don't have food at home. So every single lunch and every dinner, people invited me to their house for the whole 6 weeks. And I make my own alcohol. Wow. They just say, bring an urn of your alcohol over and come for dinner. And we'd eat tuji and whatever, hot pot, have local chicken. And I just think that everyone knew and everyone cared about me because I'm like family.
Yeah,
like you would care about your family. And I just think that's the most spectacular thing that can ever happen to anybody.
Sure.
And so when you said earlier, would you ever plan on leaving? I can't imagine it would be like leaving my family. Why would I ever want to do that? It's just such an honor to people to treat you like that.
The Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
Now let's move on to a bigger project, which is the National Rural Revitalization Campaign in this country. Actually, building or revitalizing the countryside is a mission that many countries or governments are committed to. From your observations, what is the biggest difference between China's rural reconstruction or revitalization and similar efforts in your own country? Brian?
Well, I believe in the States, what I've seen is in the rural areas, often the infrastructure is suffering a bit and it's often underfunded.
Same here,
the past. Mm. It was very, very similar. So what we've seen now is that the government is trying to rebalance some of that investment. Here in Yunnan, we are partners with Shanghai. So the Yunnan and Shanghai are paired.
Oh.
So what that means is Shanghai companies, Shanghai government, is investing into Yunnan.
Right.
So they invest some of their profits back into Yunnan to help the local to help the Yunnan government to improve the hardware of the infrastructure. And the government has done so much in that regard. So again, I feel, as I said earlier, is the idea of this gives hope to everyone. Mm-hmm. And it allows all our local friends to dream bigger, dream larger. They have the same dreams now as many of those people in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
And who's to say they can't achieve them? I believe they can here. So in many ways, we're witnessing the evolution of really this China dream that has really been special for us to observe, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Because we remember back, 20 years ago, that idea was not it's not inevitable, so.
What about in South Africa?
Yeah, in South Africa, the government tried to redistribute land because in the past, most of the farms and things in South Africa were massive and owned by one wealthy person. And so when Nelson Mandela came into power in South Africa, when the government changed, they said they wanted to redistribute land, split it up, kind of take it away from the big wealthy people and give it to local people. But the problem is there's no investment because South Africa, the government doesn't have any money, or the government somehow loses the money. And so just giving people a piece of land without access to water or yes. that's not fertile enough to grow things on doesn't work. So all that happens is people end up with a barren piece of land that they're not using, that maybe used to be a farm, but when it was a big farm, it had the central irrigation system or whatever, and now it's a small piece of land. It doesn't have that anymore, so it doesn't work. Whereas in China, when the government does something, the government has money that it can spend and enough people who are working. I think the way the government works down to very local level is very successful compared to in South Africa. So the idea is there, but it's not the money or the kind of structure in place.
It seems we've done something right here, but is there any aspect you think that needs improvement, especially in terms of reconstructing rural China?
I think there can still be more encouragement. For example, where I am in Yangshuo, in Zhoushan and on the surrounding villages, a lot of people try to do their own business, and they usually do like a nongjia fan, a farmer's restaurant, or their new house, do some guest rooms in it. But it's very hard. There's a few people who are very successful, but most people aren't.
Right.
So I think it would be good if there's some sort of initiative that says, okay, you don't have to only do these two things because there's already enough accommodation and not enough tourists. Let's think of other ways. So it'd be good if there's some group of people who could advise people and say, these are things you could do. Or, for example, you could say, okay, we're going to do a homestay thing where you can actually stay in someone's house in the village. So maybe you can set up a website or a thing you can access on your mobile phone, and you say, okay, you can go to Joseon village and you can stay with Lao Mao in his house and eat with his family. And if it's set up by a government or somebody, yes. it could make it easier for everybody. You just need one room in your house, for example, and you can make a little bit of money. So you don't need to build a hotel or you don't need to invest a lot. So I think that if there were more of these small initiatives with a well set up structure right. in place, it would give a lot of people a chance to easily make a little bit of money.
Sure.
You're saying it needs to be planned ahead or better plans?
I would think so, yeah, because like I say, if everybody does a guest house, if you now have 100 guest houses in the village, but still only 100 people coming to stay, when you had 10 guest houses, everybody had 10 guests. Now that you have 100 guest houses, everybody only has one guest. The number of people don't seem to get more, but for example, I'm just using one example.
Sure, sure.
So you need to be more diversity, so you don't all have to do the same thing. I think there needs to be some sort of thing that says, these are all the things we have. In our village, I said, why don't we rent one house and do like a museum or something? And then it's another reason to come to the village. Everyone can do, I'm a little bit busy. So I said, we can all get together, but it seems like everybody's a little bit busy. And so it doesn't happen. So it'd be good if there was some group that could say, okay, this is what we're going to do and this is what we're going to do. Everyone, or not everyone, loads of people in the village I live in make their own alcohol. We could be an alcohol selling village.
Sure, sure, sure.
But you need someone to oversee that.
We're diversified.
Yeah, yeah.
And Brian's advice?
You know, I feel similar in many ways. I feel that what we could see in maybe in rural areas is maybe more planning that incorporates the local values, maybe zoning. There's an idea of zoning where buildings can be used for certain purposes. And I just wonder in the future if maybe that's something we should be looking at.
Right.
What happens now is almost every single building in a popular destination becomes a business. And what that means then is usually with more people, you know, usually you'll have business interests coming from outside saying, I'll come in here. And what I find is there's not a real long-term commitment often from the outside businesses. Some of them, it's a lifestyle change. Some of it, it's just something they want to do and have fun or just, and this is something that I feel we could do a little better. We could do a little better with some planning and maybe zoning so that in the future villages, we would know that certain areas of villages and everything would be would remain similar. I mean, not every single building has to be a business. And if you walk around like Shizhou now, every single building is a business now.
We're still mainly a village, where I live, it's mainly a village. And Yeah, it's probably only 10% is actually.
Oh, okay.
Maybe not even. But it's not that successful, the whole village yet, not compared to here.
People would argue it's a market economy. They don't need too many plans there. Money will go where they can be profitable or they can make money, right?
But then if you have that in a market economy, you also usually have people who can invest long-term in that community. Mm. What we're finding is when you can only rent for 5 years, your commitment to the long-term development of the community is probably limited. And your children probably will not leave Shanghai, will not leave Beijing, will not leave Chengdu, because your hukou there gives them that better education, better hospitalization, medical. And what I feel that's different, I don't know how South Africa is, but at least in the States, when I moved from Chicago to a rural area in Wisconsin, and I set up an Asian kind of exhibition museum, and everything was controlled by the local people. There were no outsiders coming in really to do business. There were no franchises allowed. Mm. They would say this is popular because of its beauty, and we don't need a famous coffee shop to come into town. We don't need a famous bookstore. We'll do it ourselves. Mm. And what happened is they had the government support to do that. So I just think that in some way, maybe in the future, if we could slow down a bit and allow the locals to have seen the positives and negatives of some of the development in other old towns and say, this is what's the value to us.
Yeah.
Some of the locals here in Shijo are coming to us and saying, Brian, I feel like I'm a stranger in my home now. Mm. This is our home for 600 years.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody anymore. Yeah. I don't know what's happening. And this to me is a little sad. You're losing the soul of the village. And to me, that's something that I feel is maybe we could slow down a bit our development model now. Most of the people around the country are able to eat and they're living lives of
luxury.
And I think now let's start making decisions based on maybe social and cultural also values, not solely financial.
Mm, authorities are in many places are calling on college graduates to join the efforts in revitalizing rural China, to go to the villages. Do you think it's a good idea, or?
I think it's interesting because when we first opened for business, we had no Chinese customers. Once we started getting some customers, no Chinese customers come at all. It was only foreigners, because I think at that point, Chinese people from a village had worked so hard to be able to move to Shanghai or Beijing and buy their nice expensive apartment. They weren't going to go to some little village, they didn't have a road going to it for their holiday because they worked so hard to get away from that. And I think what started happening, probably also because of the sort of rural revitalization project, is a lot more Chinese people have already started going and staying in villages now. So then we started getting a lot more Chinese customers, and they want to do sort of, go huijia, back to the village, back to the countryside. So I think the idea of sending college graduates and stuff to villages is also very good, because I think it's important for people to have that connection of, not long ago, this is actually where you were. Mm-hmm. Probably a lot of college graduates actually were born in a village as well.
Yes.
And it's a much better life, I think, than living in the city.
A bit too much crowded, like Brian just said.
It's a challenge.
It depends what people are coming to do if they're coming to the village.
Because, say Shijou, when I arrived and 10 years ago, there were no coffee shops in Shijou.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I think you saw probably 50 coffee shops.
Yeah, I was quite excited.
And I love coffee too. And I think it's really dynamic. But when does that become a little bit inconsistent with what Shijou was and the spirit of Shijou? Is Shijou just solely a facade that can be injected with new ideas? Maybe that's the reality, and that's what a lot of young people, I think, the creativity can do in China. But I still think there's also some value to we've inherited from the past in certain areas that maybe should be marked for preservation. We do that around the world. When you go to Venice, you're not staying in a brand new concrete, cement and glass hotel. You stay in what existed in Venice for hundreds of years. The bathroom may not be very contemporary, but
that's what
you're going for. That's the experience. So we cannot just cater to a wealthy elite that need, 70 square meter bedrooms wherever they go. Because what will happen is the tradition, the real resources of these areas are going to be destroyed then in the pursuit of satisfying that small elite.
True. Then what would be your suggestions for those college graduates if they want to start their own business in villages? don't come.
No, I think, but yeah, I think it's hard. You know what I wish we could do is really just have owner-occupied purchasing power, where young people or people like you and me, we could come here and we could buy the home. Mm. And then we're invested in the community. But you have to live there. Mm. Otherwise, you would have a lot of people coming in and speculating and investors. So what happens is that would handle two things. One, it would make sure that we would invest our full energy and money in making the best thing we could do, because it's ours. Well, this idea that, you know, in some way, maybe in the future, I hope that young people can return to the villages, but invest and raise their family in these villages, bring back their talents, and also invest so that their children will be raised alongside the local children. Right. They'll go to the same schools, so that in the future, you know, maybe your village will not be solely related to the village head. He may not know everybody, but there will be a lot of people with vested interests in making sure that that community turns out okay, that the education is good, everything. And this is something that I hope, but we need to have people live there.
Yeah. Well, I think ideally, in an ideal world, this has never happened, people, if you're a college graduate or something from Shanghai, you would come and partner with somebody locally and do something together, and that would... someone from the village and someone from outside. But I think that'd be very, very hard to ever get right, because it would be people with very different ideas about how everything works. But I think that would be ideal, is you're saying, okay, you're going to come in and then you're going to be partnered with somebody from the local community, so you're going to be forced to be part of that community.
Then they would say, if a foreigner can do that, we as a Chinese...
should be able to, yeah. Yes, that's true.
I would think so. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, in many ways, Ian, we're examples of success. Mm. I mean, we've gone to very small villages, and we are continuing to grow. And
I think maybe if I have a success, it was because it wasn't planned. That's the problem. I think it was just something that happened. So I think it's much harder to plan it, because I just said, oh, come save a building. Oh dear, I'm going to do business. There's no customers. Oh, yeah, some customers arrived. Oh, I'll get another building. Hey, there's some more customers. Get another building.
What advice would you give them as someone who's so successful in doing this in rural China?
I just feel that one thing I think both of us that we share is just passion, and something that goes beyond just day-to-day business. I'm speaking for you, but I don't evaluate my success solely based on how much money I'm making. In fact, what Ian just said about being a part of the ancestors, you know, and being that part of the Mao family, that is probably the greatest, you know, the greatest treasure he could receive.
It is. Yeah.
And that to me goes far beyond any monetary benefits. Yeah. So for me, I very admire that. And I would say you're richer than you go beyond all riches.
It's my happiest story in the whole world.
And it should be.
It really is.
And I think this is something that I hope young people, I hope that you can feel it. I hope that others can someday feel that idea of being accepted, being respected for what you're giving and what you're sharing with a local community, not solely by how much money is in your pocket. And this is something that I feel he has achieved, and we hopefully are achieving well as well.
Most people I speak to in China who have lived in cities and in the countryside as adults prefer the countryside, because it's much less stressful, it's much more peaceful, you know more people, it's more friendly, a more easygoing lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I would think that's the biggest advertisement that you can have for being in the village rather than being in Shanghai or somewhere. Mm-hmm. In the village I live in Joseon Village, they actually, after I'd opened the Secret Garden and I was on TV, on Chinese TV, some Chinese people saw this program from Shanghai and Beijing and Hangzhou and wherever, and were stressed in their lives and thought, hey, if this funny little foreign bloke can come and do a business in the countryside, we can too. And they came and moved to the village, but they don't really interact with people locally, and they don't have very good relations with people in the village because they are millionaires from Beijing or Shanghai coming to what is still a reasonably poor village and don't interact with people. So I would say if you are a college graduate and your life is stressful or you are living in a big city, move to the countryside, but interact with people locally, meet the amazing people, and then you'll have the really lovely life. But if you just go there to make money and do business, then you really miss the best part of the whole process, which is the people and the lifestyle and everything there. So if you feel like you want to do that, make sure you go and actually meet people, and your moody, I can't think of the English word, your goal, your mission, your objective, whatever, it isn't to go and make money or something, but it's actually to have a good lifestyle. Yeah, and then you will.
Right, passion.
Passion. Believe in what you're doing.
And, right, is the prerequisite of doing everything successfully, probably. Yeah. And the last but not least, can you share with our listeners your vision for the future?
Our personal vision is okay, or?
Yes.
Okay. I guess for my wife and me, for the two of us, we hope in some way to stay in China forever. Mm-hmm. We have invested all our money, you know, everything here. We raised our children here. This is their home as well. Mm-hmm. Our youngest son will return to China in August or September. Right. He just finished his graduate degree in environmental planning, and he will join our team. My goal is to continue to tell the real stories of China to the outside world. Mm-hmm. And those stories go beyond just what is happening in the big cities. And it's the stories of the local people. It's the stories that Ian, I'll be telling Ian's story now to friends. And these are the things that I really feel are very, very important. So I hope to remain here forever. And if the Chinese people welcome us, we would love to stay.
Yeah, of course, we welcome you all. And Ian, what are you going to do when Secret Garden's 20-year lease expires?
Go move here and join our team. Together, okay? Lago, lago.
Yeah, hey, it's a binding, verbal contract is binding. As long as I keep getting visas, I also want to keep staying in China forever. I've been really, really lucky. At the Secret Garden, we have 26 landlords altogether for the different buildings. And I don't have any troubles with any of the landlords ever. And I'd be very happy, I think there's about 7 or 8 years left on most of the buildings for Secret Garden. I'd be very happy then to return all those properties to the landlords in, my ideal little world I live in, where sometimes it comes true. They would be able to keep on running the business themselves. I mentioned I have another guest house, The Lost World, in Sanjiang, Qianyang Bazai, which we just started 5 years ago. So those buildings, ancient wooden houses, that we still have 15 years to go on that lease. And then I've just rented one new house, also next to the Yulong River in Yangshuo, near the Yulong Bridge, which the government, the local government, Baisha government, actually asked me if I would find people to rent houses in that village, because they saw that once we opened a Secret Garden, then all the other houses got rented out and people in the village all got to make more money and had more work opportunities. So I took some people, some friends, to look at houses, and they all decided they didn't want a house in the village. So I got one more house.
Oh, cool.
And I'm working on that at the moment. But that's just going to be one building, which I'm going to let out to people completely. So that's got 20 years to go. So by then I'll be 70 or something. So I'll probably rent another building and keep on going. I think I'm like happier than anyone I know. I have the most amazing life. I absolutely love it. And I just want to keep doing this. And I don't want to retire. I just want to keep working. And it's so amazing to keep getting all these opportunities just to do what you want to do.
Exactly.
And to be able to help some other people and to, actually make a small difference somehow. It's so lucky. So I want to keep on for another 50 years.
Yeah, I think Chinese people would love you both to stay here like forever and as a family here.
Yeah, yeah.
So
we would love to do that.
Yes.
Lago, lago.
Good luck. And thanks for joining our chat today.
Thank you for having us.
It was a really great pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
It was our pleasure.
We're always honored. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you so much for asking us to be here.
And with that, we wrap up our chat today. Many thanks to Brian Linden, founder of Xingyuan, or the Linden Center in southwestern China's Yunnan province, and Ian Hamilton, founder of the Secret Garden in South China's Guangxi Zhuang Autonomous Region, for sharing your stories with our listeners. If you have any comments on the topic or the show, please feel free to message us. Just search Chat Lounge. You can find us on all major podcast platforms or send us an email to radio@cgtn.com. I'm Tu Yun. Thank you for being with us. We'll have more chat next week.